This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. When you think about science, what comes to mind? Important, maybe intimidating, but how about hilarious?
I think Bill Nye is pretty hilarious.
I always think of him.
Yeah.
We'll hear about a program in Denver that's working to change how we see science and scientists.
The number of people dying from breast cancer has gone down, but the mortality rate is still higher for one group of women. We'll find out how survivors are supporting those facing a cancer diagnosis in an unexpected place.
There is just not enough water in the Colorado River to go around. So what does that mean for the seven states that rely on the river?
Mother Nature is really kind of forcing us to the table right now.
We get an update on plans to close the gap between the river's supply and the people's demand. And film critic Howie Moshevitz reviews Studio 54.
Plus, with the midterm elections just a few days away now, we'll have a few last-minute items on the ballot for you. But first, the number of hate crimes is going up in the U.S. The deadly attack on a synagogue in Pittsburgh is one of the latest hate crimes here in the U.S. In 2016, according to the latest FBI data, more than 6,000 hate crimes were reported, motivated by biases against things like race, religion, or sexual orientation. Whether the same thing is happening in the more rural parts of the country, like the Mountain West, is harder to say because of a lack of data. Robin Merrill is an attorney for the Human Rights Campaign.
The absence of rural data doesn't necessarily indicate that there's not a problem. It just indicates that we don't have the data.
Every year, the FBI collects statistics on the number of crimes from local law enforcement agencies. But Merrill says because it's a voluntary program, rural counties and cities don't always participate. Wyoming is one of five states without a statewide hate crime law even on the books. Colorado's hate crime has a penalty enhancement for crimes motivated by race, religion, or ethnicity.
Last month marked National Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and since it started more than three decades ago, the number of people dying from the disease has dropped by about 39%. But as KUNC's Stephanie Daniel reports, one group of women in Colorado has a higher mortality rate than others.
On a recent Sunday morning, I attended services at Shorter Community AME Church in Denver. Founded in 1868, it's Colorado's first African-American church. But today's message is a bit different because it's Pink Sunday.
Thank you, Jesus. Being an 11-year breast cancer survivor, I want to thank Jesus for allowing to be here and stand before you this morning.
Tracy Drayton is informing congregants about an important fact. The mortality rate for Black women in Colorado is nearly 30% higher than white women.
Why? Why are women, Black women, dying more than white women?
African-American women, we just tend to have factors that influence a poor prognosis.
That's Mabel Peters. She works in oncology research at Kaiser Permanente in Denver.
Genetic differences in the tumors, barriers to health care.
According to Susan G. Komen, a breast cancer organization, Black women are more likely to be diagnosed at a younger age, at later stages of the disease, and with a more aggressive form of the cancer. But Komen, Colorado CEO Jill Fricker, believes it goes deeper than that. She says people should think about the systematic issues surrounding health disparities.
You know, I think Black women don't always feel comfortable going to a doctor's office where all white employees work. I think there's still some institutional racism that Black women face as they navigate the system.
Diane Simpson is a two-time cancer survivor. Her first bout with the disease was in 1992.
That was a time when people did not talk about breast cancer.
She was 39 and in the process of adopting her daughter.
At that time, I felt so devastated. I mean, just in terms of the physical effects, losing my hair or being told that I would lose my hair because of chemotherapy. And so really most of my support came from my oncologist.
To help women like Simpson handle these issues, Komen, Colorado formed the African American Advisory Council in 2012. Mabel Peters is part of the group.
We're there for them for whatever reason that we need, whatever education you need. If you need a doctor, you don't have any insurance, there's programs out there to help you and assist you to get your mammogram.
They also provide breast health awareness materials to churches around the Denver area for Pink Sunday services.
Do you realize that women are not aware of where they can get resources from? There may be a financial burden to them. Where do they go? This is all a part of educating women and also educating our community.
Remember Tracy Drayton at Shorter Community AME Church? She's also part of the advisory council and leads the church's breast cancer ministry that's been around for about 18 years. For her, a support system is critical.
You may have your family, you may have your friends, but to be in a group where women are like you or you're like them is really helpful.
It's something that motivated Diane Simpson to help start Shorter's breast cancer ministry. The goal, she says, was to not only serve church members, but the community as well.
I believe we really filled a void during those early years, and so that people were able to come to us, or people who were diagnosed or their family members would call us. We even had a hotline, I think, at one point.
And when the cancer came back 3 years ago, the ministry was there for her.
Many people came to me and helped me and my family to get through that very stressful time the second time. And it would have helped to have had that the first time back in the early 90s.
Stephanie Daniel, KUNC, in Denver.
So, Carly, did you hear about this crazy thing that happened this week?
I did not.
Okay. Governor John Hickenlooper told a barista at a New Hampshire coffee shop that he was going to run for president.
That's insane.
He walked it back pretty quickly, and a spokesman for the governor later claimed that he was just joking. But a political observer who once worked for him thinks the comments weren't just made to get a laugh. KUNC's Scott Franz has more.
Scott Wasserman says he was surprised when he heard his former boss make the presidential announcement in front of a camera Wednesday morning. Wasserman once served as Hickenlooper's deputy chief of staff. He thinks the governor was sending out a trial balloon.
It just felt to me like in that moment, he wanted to gauge reaction and try that statement on and see how it felt for himself, as well as for the people he was talking to.
Wasserman says in previous campaigns, moments like this may not have been caught on camera. He thinks Hickenlooper came across as authentic and someone a voter would want to have a beer with. Scott Franz, KUNC.
Water managers along the Colorado River are trying to figure out how to live with less. Climate change is growing the gap between the river's supply and demands in the seven states that use it. The federal government recently released proposals designed to keep the river's biggest reservoirs from crashing. Reporters Luke Runyon from KUNC and Brett Jaspers from KJZZ in Arizona break things down for us.
Okay, Brett, let's dig into what's actually in these plans. To start, I think it's probably important to know that the river is divided into two halves, the upper basin, which includes Rocky Mountain states,
and the lower basin, states that make up the desert Southwest.
Both are having big problems with their main reservoirs. In the upper basin, it's Lake Powell. Water levels there are dropping fast. But at the same time, there's no incentive for people in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico to conserve water and fill it up.
And in the lower basin, the problem is overuse. Essentially, more water exists on paper than in the river itself, and that supply-demand gap is causing the country's biggest reservoir, Lake Mead, to drop as well. So, Luke, what's the upper basin solution?
One big piece is a water bank. Think of Lake Powell like a checking account. Water comes in and goes out based on the needs downstream. But for a long time now, more has left the account than come in. And there's a worry that eventually the check will bounce, that downstream states will order water and the account will be empty. That could kick off years of litigation, something Wyoming state engineer Pat Terrell definitely doesn't want to happen.
That is a parade of horribles that we don't want to see. And so Mother Nature is really kind of forcing us to the table right now. And
staying with the banking analogy, how do they propose to keep things in the black?
They basically want to create a savings account within the reservoir. This would be a pool of water just to make sure they never run a deficit. Water would stay in Lake Powell and only get released downstream if the entire account was nearly in the red. And it could be used as sort of a last-ditch emergency cash payment to states like California, Nevada, and Arizona.
What do people up there think about that idea?
Well, the creation of the savings account itself isn't controversial. It's the how you fill it up part that gets people nervous, because there's lots of unanswered questions about how you do that. But for now, Wyoming's Terrell says they're just concerned with creating the savings account.
This cake isn't baked. We haven't even opened the door to the kitchen yet. All we're getting so far is the ability to store some water.
So, Brett, what's going on where you are?
Well, the Lower Basin deal is unique because for the first time, California's willing to cut back its water deliveries under certain conditions.
Don't they have the most primo rights on the river?
They do, but in the Lower Basin plan, they've agreed to take cutbacks when Lake Mead drops below a certain level. And they're now willing to do that partly because California has an incentive, a decade-old program called Intentionally Created Surplus, or ICS.
How does that work?
Well, before ICS was a thing, a water user had to take its water or lose it. But now a user can conserve water on Lake Mead and then get the water back at a later date, thereby intentionally creating a surplus for itself. The new drought contingency plan would expand the ICS program, and that's got everyone on board.
How so?
Well, it removes limits on when water can be withdrawn. Now, there's some disagreement about what the current rules say, but the DCP should remove a lot of that ambiguity. And so all the states have more reason to store water on Lake Mead because they have more flexibility in withdrawing it later.
And it seems like whether these plans actually come together is still a pretty big if.
And there's a tight timeline. Federal officials want this done by the end of the year.
That's one source of pressure on these water managers. Another is the weather. If it's another dry winter, expect the heat to get turned up even more to get these agreements done. I'm Luke Runyon in Colorado.
And I'm Brett Jaspers in Arizona.
This story is a part of Elemental, covering sustainability, a new multimedia collaboration between public radio and TV stations in the West, supported by a Walton Family Foundation grant.
Okay, so Carly, if I asked you to describe a scientist, what kind of words would you use?
I think I would go with white lab coat, smarter than me,
Maybe, yeah. I'm going to guess hilarious would not be on your list of adjectives.
Unless it's Bill Nye, no.
Well, maybe it should be. Coming up, we'll visit a most unlikely laboratory that's working to help scientists tap into their inner stand-up. Plus, we'll find out if the new Studio 54 documentary is a timely update or just a tired retread.
But before we get to that, guns, gun control, and the Second Amendment are a hot-button issue across the country and right here in Colorado. KUNC is embarking on a new reporting project to cover the subject of guns in America. Lee Patterson will be reporting on these stories for us. She talked with KUNC's Kyra Buckley.
So tell us more about the program.
Guns in America is a two-year fellowship. There are 10 reporters based at 10 public media stations around the country, and we'll be reporting on all things related to guns from many, many different perspectives with context and nuance, of course. And the goal here is to get beyond breaking news on guns by taking an in-depth look at the role of guns in American life. And for me, that will be from a Colorado perspective.
And as part of your work on this new beat, you have been crunching data, trying to get a better idea of what gun-related crimes look like in Colorado.
Yeah, and one data set that really stuck out to me was the number of assaults involving firearms statewide. So between 2001 and 2016, those crimes have gone up by about 200%.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is a lot. And even once we accounted for population change, the trend is still there. There was still a large increase. And of course, cities like Denver, Aurora, Colorado Springs have the largest share of these types of crimes.
Do we know why this is happening?
Well, I spoke with Division Chief of Patrol Ron Thomas. He's with the Denver Police Department. And he said that actually part of what's going on has to do with young people. And some of this is gang related and some of it's not.
I don't know what has led to young people trying to get their hands on weapons and then using those weapons to commit violent crimes. But that does seem to be the consistent and growing trend.
You also went over to the Denver District Attorney's Office to dig into this trend. What did you find there?
I met with Kelly Wadler. She is a senior deputy district attorney. And Wadler said, of course, that there are a lot of different things going on, but that for her, one important factor is a connection between property crimes and violent crimes.
I see accessibility to weapons seeming to increase. So people are breaking into homes and into cars and recovering guns from those homes and cars.
One important thing to know is that according to the Denver Police Department, the number of guns stolen from cars has sharply increased over the years. And so far this year, there have been at least 112 guns stolen from cars. Wadler also said that law enforcement and the district attorney's office have gotten better at identifying and solving crimes, partially because there have been big advances in technology.
When it comes to the increase in young people involved in crimes, do we know what's going on there?
Well, I'm going to do more reporting on the issue to find out what young people themselves have to say. But I did pose that question to Kelly Wadler.
That's the million-dollar question. If we could completely pinpoint that, then we could get a quick handle on it. I don't think it's that simple. I think there are a lot of reasons for it. One thing that I see a lot of is social media playing a role in this, because young people are so connected through technology that it is very easy for them to set up robberies. It's very easy for them to air a grievance they have with another young person and have that be very public, and then to engage in some sort of violent crime.
We've been talking about trends in Denver within the larger context of assaults involving firearms going up across the state. But how does Colorado compare to other states?
There are a couple of ways to look at it. First, you can look at just the number of assaults involving firearms. And in Colorado in 2016, there were around 3,600 of these crimes reported. That's the 17th highest number of assaults involving firearms in the country. Now, if we look at the rate of assaults, Colorado's pretty much in the middle. There are around 70 incidents per 100,000 people. For the sake of comparison, there are similar rates in states like Oklahoma and Indiana.
Lots to dig into. Lee, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
That was KUNC's Lee Patterson. She's going to spend the next 2 years reporting on gun issues for the new reporting collaborative Guns in America. You can learn more at gunsinamerica.org.
There's a common stereotype that scientists aren't funny. They're smart, they're antisocial, maybe a little odd, but definitely not funny. Now, one organization is out to prove that myth wrong by showing that science can be a riot. KUNC Arts reporter Stacey Nick has more.
While his degree is in geology, John Kinetiman of Aurora has a secret dream: to be a stand-up comedian.
I've always thought I was funny. Maybe others have not thought I was funny, but I definitely do. So I just wanted to go on stage and give it a shot.
So you guys all theoretically at least have several paragraphs of information you want the audience to walk away with.
But before hitting the stage, Kinetiman spent 3 weeks in a classroom learning about comedy.
I think there was a lot of insider baseball to the jokes I was making.
That's why we're going over this in the group, just because... To us, like, we don't know anything about geology.
That's Jessie Hansen. By day, she's a medical laboratory scientist. But by night, she teaches courses on science comedy for the national nonprofit group Science Riot.
I take STEM field professionals, so anyone involved in science, technology, engineering, or mathematics. I teach them a 3-week writing workshop and how to write stand-up comedy and use that as an outreach tool.
But Hansen says scientists aren't always great at talking with non-scientists about what they do. Only 1 in 5 actively participate in outreach to the adult public. But how do you teach being funny? First, students learn some of the finer points of telling a joke.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Dwayne.
Dwayne.
Dwayne the insurance salesman. It's not a funny joke, is it? Because I resolved that tension in a very expected way. An insurance salesman has every reason to be on your doorstep, so it's not funny if you say that he shows up. So let's try that one more time. Knock, knock.
Who's
there? Dwayne.
Dwayne.
Dwayne the tub. I'm drowning. Still not the world's greatest joke, but it's an unexpected resolution, and you'll get at least a chuckle when people recognize what you've done to resolve the tension.
Sometimes it takes a while for the lesson to sink in. Laura Farrow teaches biology at the Community College of Denver and is a marine biologist by training. Her first comedy assignment was a bit about her work researching sharks.
In order to do this, I was on this very small island with a very weird man. And
But for the next 6 minutes, Pharaoh talked about everything but that small island or that weird man. Afterwards, her classmates wanted to know more. Turns out the other researcher was working on a study on dominance.
Literally, his plan was to swim around naked with scuba gear on and try and mount the shark. So I wish I had the footage because it's amazing.
Oh, why did you leave? Why did you leave this island?
Why are we not talking about this? I didn't know if I could. I didn't know if I could. Yes.
Too often people think of physics and chemistry and biology and all these things as being boring, as being hard, as being something to be avoided.
Peter McGraw is director of the University of Colorado's Humor Research Lab, also known as HURL. McGraw studies humor, specifically the social science behind what makes things funny and how people use comedy as a tool. One way is to use humor to create a positive association with something people might otherwise see negatively, like science.
The other one is a sort of signaling process. Oftentimes, being good at comedy signals intelligence, signals wit and charm and ability. And so it can be a way to try to facilitate some interest. In some ways, comedy can help make science a little bit more cool and thus approachable.
So rocks and minerals, they form molecularly into certain ways, and they will make it so that when you hit it with a rock, they break on certain faces based on how their molecules get put together. That is cleavage.
But simply being funny isn't enough. As instructor Jesse Hansen says, you can't have science riot without the science.
We also really like looking at tits, so. And that's really all I got.
And in the beginning, at least, it was that part that student John Knetemann struggled with.
I thought it was going to be a breeze, and it was a little bit more difficult really balancing the instructive side with the funny side. I ended up just at first going more into it with using just, you know, science terminology and making it funny, but actually making it like informative and instructive and funny at the same time is an interesting balancing act.
While he probably wouldn't take these jokes to the office, Knetemann works as an analyst for a financial holdings firm focused on science companies. He thinks there is a place for the skills that he picked up in class.
Being in science marketing, you know, it's all about messaging science to be more attractive.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Stacey Nick, KUNC in Denver.
And if you're curious, you can actually catch Science Riot's next show, Peer Review. It'll be November 29th at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. You can read more about the program and listen to excerpts from this performance at KUNC.org.
The new documentary Studio 54 chronicles the spectacular rise and fall of New York's most outrageous disco club, which lasted less than 3 years. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the movie shows a lot about America, both then and now.
Studio 54 was the dream become actual of two guys from Brooklyn, Steve Rebell and Ian Schrager. They met at Syracuse University, became dear friends even though Schrager was a straight introvert and Rebell was a gay extrovert, at a time when that could be even more dangerous than now. In 1977, they fashioned this place where the beautiful people came to drink, snort, dance ecstatically, and sometimes have sex in various parts of the club. The space Schrager and Rubel chose in Manhattan, known as the Gallo Theater, had been built in 1927, and the theater history somehow held on. Rubel and Schrager didn't have the connections in New York to get club people to work for them. The other clubs froze them out. So they got theater architects, designers, and lighting people to create a magical space where everyone from guests to managers to owners to the young shirtless male waiters knew that in one way or another they were performers in an outlandish show. Even watching film of the club in action, you feel the intoxication. The mindless, repetitive disco rhythms, people dancing as if they'd left consciousness at the door. Everyone was welcome, but not really, of course. Studio 54 thrived on keeping people out and having constant news broadcasts of the throngs outside who were not hip enough to be allowed past the ropes on the sidewalk. British journalist Anthony Hayden Guest, a chronicler of indulgent wealth and celebrity, says in the movie that it was like the damned looking into paradise. The genius of Matt Turnauer's documentary is that the picture lets you look without a lot of judgment. Most of the people who talk in the film were there at the time. They still sound enthusiastic and amazed at what happened, but not demented or with axes to grind. So if moral judgment shows its head, it's from viewers, who may still be surprised at the sight of this palace of hedonism. The film shows that Studio 54 is still a phenomenon of human behavior, and the movie's a remarkable historical artifact. You see the kinds of people who congregated there, and if you weren't around at the time, there's Andy Warhol in nearly every shot, Mick Jagger and Bianca Jagger, actresses Liza Minnelli and Elizabeth Taylor, Truman Capote, and I suppose anyone who was anyone at the time. It's celebrity culture run wild, that certain class of people celebrating themselves. Schrager was interviewed for the film. Rebel died in 1989, and Schrager talks about the wonder of people letting loose to be themselves. And that, too, is an idea that resounds and fascinates through the movie. What does it mean to be oneself? Is someone being oneself all costumed up and performing and doing it just like all the others? It was never innocent. Rebel and Schrager learned early on how to cut corners. They were in too much of a hurry to get building permits. For months, they had no liquor license, but each day got a catering license for the evening. They had two sets of books. They hid quaaludes and cash in the nooks and ceilings. Schrader still deludes himself that the IRS went after them because they upset the norm. Not. They went to jail for major tax fraud, for stealing. The lawyer Rubel and Schrager engaged from the beginning was Roy Cohn, the infamous slimy figure who became a New York celebrity, and who had begun his career with Joe McCarthy, the Wisconsin senator who gave his name to the disgrace called McCarthyism. Cohn's also a central character in the great play Angels in America. The reach of Studio 54, the movie, is deep and wide. You can learn a lot from the film about America then and now, and you'll also get a feel for why the place was so attractive to so many. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
And one last thing before we get out of here. If you were out and about for Halloween trick-or-treating, you might have seen a few pumpkins that were painted teal. And you might have wondered, what is the story with that? Well, on Halloween, a handful of years ago, a Tennessee parent displayed a teal pumpkin in front of their house to signal that they had non-food treats for kids with allergies or dietary restrictions. Now it's taken off with the help of allergy awareness groups. It's called the Teal Pumpkin Project, and it's a nationwide awareness campaign. Nancy Gregory is with the organization Food Allergy Research and Education. She says 1 in 13 kids in the U.S. has a food allergy that could be life-threatening. So having non-food options, things like stickers or bouncy balls, can help make Halloween more inclusive for all kids.
It might be a very simple gesture, but it means quite a bit to a child who may be accustomed to having to come up with some sort of alternate tradition.
And although Halloween is, of course, over for now, hey, you can get a head start on next year. You can learn more, download yard signs, and find allergy-safe houses in your neighborhood at tealpumpkinproject.org.
And one last thing. This Sunday marks the end of daylight saving time. Enjoy your one extra hour of sleep.
Oh, man. I'll probably end up using mine raking leaves. They're all over the yard right now. How about you, Carly?
I'll be here bright and early for weekend edition, and then maybe a nap.
A nap is always a good idea. This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from RKUNC members. You guys rock. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat, who also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. We also heard Broke for Free with Golden Hour, Dr. Turtle, Stuff Will Never Love You Back, Loyalty Freak Music with Lag,
Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong and Hot Yacht Bot, and Steve Combs with Halloween. Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.